Hitler if you think we're on the run.
Yes, hello and welcome to episode 44 of the Dad's Army podcast. This is going to be primarily a commentary episode, and we're going to be discussing the Honourable Man. But prior to that, there's been, well, one piece of news that's pushed Dad's Army into the public eye. Oliver's here once again to discuss that piece of news. Hello, Oliver.
Hello, James.
It's not very common these days that Dad's Army makes it into the news in a completely fresh, brand new piece of news. We're talking, of course, about the controversy that was picked up on by pretty much every national paper here in the UK and some overseas as well, about the game. Do you remember the old Dad's Army game?
Yeah, I've never seen it, but was aware that it existed. And yeah, I think I emailed you to say, have you seen this story? And I think Andrew Ruff tipped me off about it, the Dad's Army photographer.
Just to give a bit of background, the actual board game itself went up on eBay. The cover of the box has got a swastika on it, in the same way that the normal Dad's Army logo has. I won't go through the entire news article. I mean, you can Google it and it will come up all over the place.
Yes, absolutely bizarre. I think the chap who put it up there said, how can the most innocent sitcom in the world be branded in this sort of racist news controversy? It's really is really random.
I think this is a complete non-story, really, but having said that, I want to have my say on it as well. And I think it's really interesting because a story like this generates massive diverse kind of opinion. And I've read articles where people say, of course Dad's Army's not racist. How can Dad's Army be racist? You know, it's incredibly gentle and mild and everything. And I completely agree with that sentiment, but it's not actually the argument.
No, absolutely. Yeah. No, yeah.
No one is actually saying Dad's Army is racist. And the guy who actually posted this up on eBay has gone off on that track, and he's defending Dad's Army when nobody actually accused it of being racist in the first place.
No, that's a very fair point.
I think there's definitely an issue about people profiteering out of Nazi memorabilia, for example, but the swastika in the context of Dad's Army is just that, it's in context.
Yes.
It's not a swastika in isolation, it's not propaganding any kind of message of hate, certainly not on the top of a game, a box houses a game. So I think eBay have completely shot themselves in the foot on this occasion, and I can't understand how anyone can actually say that this particular game represents any kind of racist material, and I think they've got it completely wrong.
And I can't imagine anyone actually seeing it and complaining. You know, this is eBay themselves who've done this. I cannot, you know. It's really, really bizarre, you know. But
Of course, you've got another group of individuals who are basically those who jump on the PC gone mad brigade, and of course it set them off terribly. So you've got something that's fairly innocuous that set a whole bunch of people off on a rant, you know, which are saying this is you know, political correctness completely out of context, which it is, but unfortunately it gives a voice to a group of individuals who sometimes probably shouldn't have such a loud voice.
So. I agree.
You're listening to the Dad's Army podcast with your host, James.
A few episodes ago, we interviewed Nicholas Ridley, that's Arnold Ridley's son, who's written a book called Godfrey's Ghost that's all about his relationship with Arnold Ridley. And he kindly donated a copy of that book and signed it, and he asked a question. Now, the question was, in the test, who was Godfrey's batting partner? And the answer, of course, is Sergeant Wilson. And we had 74 entries into this.
Here we go.
Which was a pretty, pretty good response. So, Oliver, if you can give me a number between 1 and 74.
Oh, right, okay. I'm going to go with 37.
37. 37 is David Ryder. So congratulations, David. I'll drop you an email to say that you've won this book. And if you can send me your address, then we'll get it out to you in the post. Now, Trevor Cass, who's another regular listener to the podcast, has read this book and has written a short review, which I thought we would go through very quickly. And he says, as a long-time devourer of biography, I suppose my approach to Godfrey's Ghost was predictable and therefore something of a mistake. With the help of his father's own unpublished notes, the loving son writes an account of the father's life, but the book is at once both more and less than that. Highly personal, well, of course it would be, but it's also subjectively reflective, to an extent mournful and self-critical, in short, almost as much about the writer as the subject. Perhaps these attributes could have happily coexisted if the narrative thread of his father's life had been more robustly set down. As it is, the reader is obliged continuously to reorientate himself, as the reflective reveries are fired off at times with a tiring rapidity, and the hard work of establishing who is speaking of whom and in what context is almost continuous. At times, the enlightenment so obtained adds to the sum of the parts, but often the thought is contrived and inconsequential. As one works one's way into the book, the fog lifts and we are offered a fascinating vignette. I'm not sure if I've said that word correctly. Vignette?
Yeah.
Of Arnold Ridley's life, and of particular note are his World War I experiences, his stage writing and production, and his later acting career, but some greater detail of his World War II involvement might have referenced his dad's army portrayal and given a little more depth to that substantial aspect of his career. Towards the book's end, the reflective fog settles back and there is more reverie than review, but all for that, it is a sensitive, sincere and loving work, and perhaps its style says as much about the father as the son. Thank you, Trevor. That's a really, really good review.
I definitely agree, actually. I found myself having to often go back to re-establish who it was I was reading. I mean, I think it's an excellent book, but absolutely the style, the way it is written, I agree that it is probably as much about Nicholas as it is Arnold and their relationship, which is fair enough. But yeah, totally. When I first read it, it took a while to get my head around the format. But fair play, you don't want everything to be the same. You know, Sheila Hancock wrote a book about her and John Four. It was a double autobiography. You had a chapter about her life, a chapter about John Four, and then when they married, it was their life together. And that was a successful format that worked, with bits of her diary interlaced. I think a similar format perhaps could have worked, you know, if you're just going to go all out and say, this is my book and my dad's book. But that's for everyone's entitled to an opinion about that. But thank you very much, Trevor. It's a brilliant review.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, we're going to get into the meat and potatoes then of this particular podcast. We're going to get on with our commentary of The Honourable Man. Just before we do, just a few housekeeping announcements, if you like. We're going to have a very special guest on podcast 45, and I'm going to be talking with this special guest about The Man and the Hour, the very first Dad's Army episode. So please feel free to send in your comments, and we'll take those into account when we record our review of The Man and the Hour. That's james@dadsarmypodcast.com. Feel free to leave a message for us on Twitter. You can follow us at twitter.com/dadsarmypodcast. And as always, keep an eye on the Dad's Army Podcast blog, which is dadsarmypodcast.blogspot.com. Come.
Yes.
There we go. It's not as if I sound like I'm reading those, is it? Anyway, without any further ado, we'll get into the commentary. As per usual, you'll hear some music in a moment. You'll hear a 3, 2, 1 play countdown. And when you hear play, press the play button on your computer or on your DV, however it is that you're going to be watching this episode. And for the time being, that's all for now, so we'll catch up with you soon.
Hope you enjoy the commentary. It's one of my favourite Dad's Army episodes, and hopefully we'll give you some useful feedback about the episode along the way. Thanks so much for listening.
Hello, I'm Max Buffer.
And I'm Terry Bland.
And we're from the Max Buffer's Media Museum podcast.
We take you back to shows you may have missed,
such as the sci-fi spectacular Infestoid.
And shows we'd love to make,
including Get Your Chops Round This,
TV Phone Sex Tragedy,
and Britain's Got Orphans.
So catch us on your actual iTunes or
at www.mediamuseum.co.uk.
Three, two, one, play. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Dad's Army podcast. Now, I didn't come up with a number then because at the point of recording, we don't know which episode this is going to be. But Oliver is with me again. Hello, Oliver.
Hello, James.
And this is going to be a commentary of the season 6 episode, The Honourable Man. Now, this is your choice, isn't it, Oliver, this particular episode?
It is. It's probably my equal favourite along with Mum's Army. But I love this episode. If I was to say what my favourite aspect of Dad's Army is, it's probably the class banter between Mannering and Wilson, and I think there's no better episode to show it than this one.
Mm.
And I think it's a very, very funny episode.
Yeah, I could completely agree. I think the whole message of Dad's... I'd say the whole success of Dad's Army is the way that they subtly play on the class differential between Mannering and Wilson. And I think this episode is the only one where they almost put a colour photograph into a negative, because they bring that part to the fore. Because they actually expose it and they address it head on.
Yes.
And there is no doubt in this episode that Wilson is of a superior class to Mannering. My goodness, Arthur Lowe and John LeMessurier absolutely relish the opportunity.
Oh, they're brilliant.
Because you've got Arthur Lowe trying to play a slightly aggrieved, very pompous and proud man all within one performance.
Yes.
And I think that's probably quite hard to do.
Yeah.
I would say. So,
but this vacating the chair a bit is slightly cheap, but it is fun.
Mm.
But you know, it's early in the episode. I think it can be forgiven for quite...
it's all right. Yeah. I mean, we're at another committee scene here within Dad's Army. And I think the difference... We discussed an episode a little while ago that features a committee scene as well. And the difference in this one is that James Beck is present.
And I believe this was his last studio recording.
Absolutely right.
Mm.
Absolutely right. He did a couple of radio episodes after this.
Right.
Off the top of my head, he says, consulting his notes, I know one of them was A Stripe for Fraser, and I can't remember what the other one was. But yeah, you're right, this is the very last time we see James Beck in a studio.
Yeah, it's very sad. Very sad indeed. You know, I think he's a wonderful character and a very, very good actor.
Mm.
And yes, really sad.
It adds a little bit of poignancy when you watch this.
Yeah.
When you know that he didn't go into another recording studio.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it is very sad. Talking of sad events, you've got Claude Gordon there as well in the opening scene. Played
Eric Longworth.
Spectacularly by Eric Longworth,
yeah,
yes.
Who recently passed away, Eric... I never met Eric, but I've seen photos of him. He didn't age, did he? I mean, he looked like...
I think he got to about 60, and then he didn't change.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Occasionally, he changed his glasses.
Oh, right,
and that
okay.
was about it. But no, I met Eric on a number of occasions, and he was a fairly staple part of any Dad's Army Appreciation Society events, and I last saw him at the 40th anniversary event that was held in London at the Imperial War Museum last year. And of course, I had absolutely no idea. No one had any idea that was going to be the last time that they saw him at such an event. But he was always a massive supporter of the spirit of Dad's Army. And of course, that's what the Appreciation Society champions more than anything. And it was really very sad. But You get to a point when you follow Dad's Army and you do realise that these actors were old when they recorded the programme.
Yes.
And therefore, when they pass, it's still very, very sad, but it's to be expected. And it is hard trying to be quite a dedicated follower of a programme where, you know, passing of actors is actually something that becomes almost... normal.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's hard to say exactly what I'm thinking. But,
something I just noticed then, Jimmy Beck has a ring on his little finger, which made me then start studying people's wedding ring fingers. Arthur isn't wearing one. His character is married. And a lot of the other actors aren't. I think Eric Longworth's got one on.
I'm not sure. I know Arthur Lowe wears a ring on his little finger as well.
You're absolutely right, yeah.
But
no. Frank still does as well. But yeah, I wonder whether that was a thing where they said, well, you can't wear your wedding ring fingers because your wedding rings because your character isn't married. But then why not have one wearing them? I don't. I mean, because the reason I bring it up is I was thinking, well, what wonderful it is to see everyone in their civilian costumes in this, and it's a true credit to the designers that they really got some wonderful costumes for everyone. And I just wondered how meticulous they were. Oh, John Lemaitre is wearing one on his little finger as well. Are they called signet rings? Is that the right?
Oh, I couldn't tell you. No idea. No idea.
Yeah, it's quite.
But it is interesting.
I love this. Oh, just a moment.
Yes. Now, I've got to be honest, this is it's slightly concerning for me because, you know, the expression Menuhin uses sometimes where he threatens Pike, if you do such and such again, you can go in the office and close
the door.
And the reason why it's disconcerting is because that's exactly what my father used to say to me.
Really?
When I was growing up. He also used to call me a stupid boy. On several occasions, and for a very long period of time, I had absolutely no idea why. And yeah. I'm sure I've said that before on the podcast. But
my physics teacher used to say, "You stupid boy," and now it's so mannery. And I think back, and he was doing Arthur, you know.
Well, this is it. You see, it's funny because so much of my humour as I was growing up and really getting into Dad's Army was based on Dad's Army and stock quotes, really. You know, I always encourage people not to panic. when we were playing football at school and someone picked someone for their team, and I thought that, oh, that's a poor choice, I used to say, do you think that's wise?
Yeah.
I used to ask whether I could be excused from lessons at school.
Yeah.
If someone started showing off jewellery, I used to say, death, death, the ruby will bring you death. You know, I thought I was hilarious, but I don't think many other people, A, understood what on earth I was going on about, and two, they certainly didn't find it particularly funny. But there was so much of my humour as a kid was based purely on Dad's Army. And when I very fortunately sat next to David Croft at an Appreciation Society members' meal, I told him that story, pretty similar as I've just told you. Yeah. And he thought it was absolutely brilliant. I have to admit, he seemed to be genuinely quite chuffed.
Oh, well, it must be so. I mean, what an amazing achievement for Jimmy and David to have written something which is so well loved and still to this day is enjoyed by generations of new fans. I mean, writing doesn't get any better, does it?
It will, and it's still highly quotable.
Yeah.
I do wonder sometimes, and I know Harold Snowd has said the same. How many programmes that are screened today are we going to be celebrating the 40th anniversary of in 40 years' time? Yeah. Very, very few, I think.
Well, I think Frank summed it up very, very well at the recent Vicar and Chips event when asked, you know, why is Dad's Army so popular? Well, Jimmy and David set it in the past, so it was always going to be timeless. And I think he's absolutely right. Dad's Army doesn't date because it's already doing something in the past, and so it can be shown over and over and over again.
I know. I mean, and I did understand his point there, but I also wondered, does that therefore mean any programme that's set during a fixed period in the past, I mean, he's going to be good, because it doesn't actually mean that.
You're right there.
What he's saying, I think, is that because not only did they set it in the past, but that fact combines with the fact that they can just write so well.
Yes, yes.
The two things there gel into something unique.
Yes.
And Frank used the comparison of it ain't our foot, Mum. And to me, and this is just my personal opinion, I don't think that's written anywhere near as well as Dad's Army.
No, I would agree.
I don't think the characters are as well-rounded. I don't think they're as deep.
No.
And I don't think the settings and situations the characters found themselves in were as believable.
No.
And, you know, I still think it looks, you know, quite good. The production values are as good as Dad's Army, almost, I would say. And yet it just doesn't have that air of authenticity. I mean, you look at this scene that we've got here. I mean, even Pike's style, the way he styled his hair, you know, it's completely and utterly believable.
Yeah.
The sandbags in the back of Manorin's office, the way that it's been, you know, the wall has been bricked up following some bomb damage.
Yeah.
And it's just that little.
And there was the continuity there, wasn't there? But they actually I admire this, that they maintained the continuity in this sort of section of Dad's Army when there's all the gaff in one episode where they're trying to go through the door and it's all go around it. Mm. Where have you last seen your money?
That was it.
That was the episode. And then gradually in that series it's patched up and rebuilt. And I like the fact that they had a continuity to the series.
Well, given that there's very little dialogue that you can call continuity based, I mean, there are a couple, but there's not many references. To have the sets take on the continuity, I think, shows that there is a story being played out over a period of time.
Yeah.
And you're right, I think it's done very, very effectively. Now, this of course, is the scene here where Menarin first finds out that Wilthon is actually of,
an honourable.
There you are, he's an honourable, yes.
This is the scene I think of when I think of this episode. My brother is... sort of not as much of a Dad's Army fan as I, but we used to watch it together, and his favourite character by far is Wilthon. And I remember watching this with him, and he just found it absolutely hilarious. But I mean I think some of the best scenes happen in this office. I mean, and another example, just to digress ever so slightly, is when Pike accidentally pours the sawdust into Mannering's coffee and you expect him to go nuts, and he says, "That's a very nice cup of coffee," and it's totally not what you expect.
No.
And I think that's in the last series. Even then, they had surprises. For something which a lot of comedies are very formulaic, keeping up appearances is very formulaic. Even though it's funny, it's the same gags about the room for a pony and all that kind of stuff. Whereas Dad's Army, throughout its run, kept surprising the audience, in my opinion, even though it was the same setup.
No, it did, and it really used its strengths very, very well, and the strengths were the characters.
Yes, rather than the gags.
Well, oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Because half of these, if you were to take the gags in isolation, I think some of them are, uniquely funny, but you suddenly put those with a different set of actors, and they're not as funny. And I think that's been demonstrated quite clearly through the stage production of Dad's Army. And, they've basically lifted a script. They've adapted a script for stage. They made some minor alterations.
Yeah.
But some of the things that you hear Arthur Lowe coming out with are exactly the same as what's translated into the stage version. And Timothy Keightley, who played Mannerin, and Peter Martin have played Mannerin, they're saying the same lines, and it didn't work.
No,
it didn't work. The same was true with some of Godfrey's lines, definitely true with some of Pike's lines, and I think that very, very clearly shows how good these actors were.
They're wonderful. They're so. I mean, there was that. Did you see that Goodnight, Sweetheart?
Yeah.
It just doesn't work, does it?
It was, you're talking about the parody.
Yes.
So, well, I find that funny for different reasons.
Right.
I find that funny purely because they're taking off another programme that I like very much.
Yes.
And you see Nicholas Lyndhurst's character, who will always be Rodney, sorry, but even in Goodnight, Sweetheart, he's
the Sparrow, demon head master, Terence Hardiman, he's a very, very good actor.
And
Alec Linstead as well, playing Mannering in that scene. Again, he's not Arthur Lowe.
Yeah.
They do their best. This is a wonderful gag, isn't it, here?
Oh, where he's on the phone.
I pick my stuff very carefully,
Yeah. And this shows that deep down, I don't think Mannering really resents him. He just feels... It's not so much that he's got a problem with Wilthon, he's got a problem with the fact that he feels he's an underachiever.
Totally, I think you're absolutely right.
And again, there is actually a lot of depth to this, and again, if I try and even attempt to have a conversation with my wife about Dad's Army, and I use the word deep, she just laughs at me. But it is exceptionally deep, the character exploration
in
some of these lines is just brilliant.
I think... the good thing about Dad's Army is that I personally feel that when they're off the screen, they're all living their lives, you can see Jones of a butcher shop, you can see Walker out on the street saying, "Here you go, mate, you've got this for a fiver," and you can imagine them living their lives, and I think that's an amazing credit to the writing and the performers. Well, I mean, we're anyone listening to this and us two here, we're Dad's Army fans, and you know we idolize this program, and I think in our in our minds we'd love to think Warmington at Sea is existed really, but these people were there and they were doing it, you know, and in the, it's a wonderful sitcom.
No, it's very well realized, and the scenes that we've just seen with the characters sprawled around the stage, you know, having a smoke, cleaning their rifles and so on, that's one of those other staples, you know, that they revisit time and time again, and occasionally it's the setting for Fraser to go on one of his soliloquies.
Yes.
And it wasn't on this occasion, but those are the kind of character pieces that I think are brilliant, and they work for telly. Mm. But if you try and translate that into real life, I mean, if you're down a pub with four or five friends, you don't take it in turns to speak.
No,
you need to always interrupt each other. I mean, there's only two of us here, and we've interrupted each other tonight because it's how conversation flows.
Absolutely.
And despite that scenario being quite unreal, when you've got four or five people around and each taking it in turns, it still has a sincerity about it. And I think that's quite clever. I mean, people will say that's probably true of any kind of television program, perhaps, but I just think with this group of characters, it works. It just works very well. I mean, I can't really explain why.
If I might take this opportunity to say, I really am constantly impressed by the back row, as they are referred to as. I mean, you've got Colin Bean there, who was dearly missed, recently died.
Mm.
Every one of those guys are reacting to the scene. I mean, I think they don't get the credit they deserve because they really are giving these wonderful reactions. I remember right at the start, it was actually on the back row in one of the some of the early episodes, I believe some of the first in the colour, maybe seriously, there's quite a young guy at the back. And I always found that sort of strange. I mean, you know, I mean, in a way, he would have been Pike's age, so fair enough. But maybe he was called to war. Maybe that's why we never saw him again. But to me, he didn't have what these other wonderful actors here have. I mean, Desmond Cullum Jones. I recently showed Frank who played Private Desmond in the episode of the rowing boat.
Sons of the Sea.
Sons of the Sea. Where, for whatever reason, Colin Bean didn't do the last seven episodes of that series. And Desmond Cullum Jones was in a William Hartnell Doctor Who story called The War Machines, where he gets blasted by a war machine. But he has a speaking part of it, and I showed that to Frank recently. He was like, oh, wow.
But you are right, and it's been mentioned before, certainly, that the last two rows were not full of extras, because it would have been the easiest thing in the world to just get whoever happened to be available at the time, stick them in the uniforms and get them to nod at the right times and so on. And they didn't. They had a consistent set of career actors, and there were some writers in there as well.
Right, oh really?
And I mean, it was a very... I don't know why that happens, whether it was deliberate at the time or whether they just thought they wanted consistency throughout the episodes and series. I'm really not sure. It's something that I'll have to try and find out, perhaps.
Presumably, I mean, I think I've read that a lot of them were servicemen, you know, as well as being actors, they had, you know, so that they could do the rifle manoeuvres. Because it's such an important thing, if you think, I mean, these guys are in every single episode. I mean, they're just there. And if you, I mean, a viewer, even back then, I mean, people say that in modern television, the viewer has got more clever. I think there's arguments for and against that. But I think if you were sat there in 1973 watching this, and if you saw an extra in the background clearly bored or not paying attention, you would notice. And it's a credit to these guys that they are following the scene and they are deeply involved. And you believe them. You believe that I think it's, I think it's a shame that they didn't get the sort of credit that they deserve. Were many of them, do you know, in the feature film?
I think it was the same set of people. And there might have been the odd one or two changes, I think. But predominantly, the cast, the cast of the platoon
yeah.
remain the same. Occasionally, you see a kind of truncated platoon,
right?
Whereby you may just have, you know, Jones's section and number two section,
right?
And therefore, you're missing a number of people. When you see them marching, sometimes there's only a few of them as opposed yeah. to the entire platoon. So I think it's not consistent all the time in terms of the amount of members of the platoon. But yeah, predominantly they are the same people.
Interestingly, I don't believe any of the back row were in the stage show because a lot of, in fact, Eric Longworth, who we've just seen, played one of the back row, and he had a small sort of supporting part in the stage show as one of the back row.
I didn't know.
And Ronnie Grange as well. They had, I believe, actors and performers who could also dance.
Mm.
And presumably not many of the back row in the television series could have done the dancing and the singing in the stage show. And actors like Ronnie, who played several different parts and sang a number of the songs.
Mm.
So the lineup changed for the stage show. But, you know, even so, I think it's good that a lot of them were... Yeah, I mean... Private Hancock. I'm remembering the scene. I mean, there were chickens or something. Are they in a farmhouse or something? And they're saying, you know, Private Hancock. Jonesy saying they're going to go off. I think it's good that the back row were featured in the film.
No, I agree. I do think that's one thing that someone. I think it clearly was someone's opinion or someone's view that consistency was very important.
Yeah,
and. That just remains. One thing I will ask you. I mean, as I said, The Honourable Man is your choice of commentary. We've talked recently about The Recruits, which of course is probably the most Vicar-centric episode that there is, and we've also talked about. I'm desperately trying to just look for the DVD case here. Here we go. We've also talked about, or we will be talking at some point, about The Royal Train. So do you think that Series 6 is one of the best?
I do.
Do you feel? I did wonder. Yeah.
I do feel. I think this... It just got it right. I mean, well, let's face it. It's got The Deadly Attachment.
As an opener. Yeah.
I mean, it really had hit its staple. And, you know... Yes, it's very sad it's Jimmy Beck's last series. But even so, I what a credit to a sitcom for in its sixth series to pull out its best episode.
Mm.
And to me, The Honourable Man is one of the best episodes. Yeah. I mean, The Royal Train is a very popular episode, a very, you know, adventurous episode.
Yes.
You know, bit of blue screen in there and the excitement.
Mm.
And I like The Recruit, you know, again, obviously that sort of came about because Jimmy wasn't obviously available and was very ill. But it's I think it's a very, very good series. Yeah, no, absolutely right. If I had to name a best series, this would probably be it, actually.
Mm. Interesting. I did wonder. I like Series 6 very much myself. I don't think there's a poor episode in it at all. I get slightly... tired sometimes of watching the location scenes of things that go bump in a night, but aside from that,
I
really like it. And here we have Frank on a push bike and John Lemez on a motorcycle.
I mean, I wonder who doubled for John, because I doubt that this is John.
Well, I the part here where he's going over the verge, I have to admit there have been times when I've been laughing uncontrollably.
Yeah.
just because I just... Especially the part going directly across
and
the road.
Skid, yeah. And
anything happened... Because he was going so slowly, he could have just got off.
Yeah.
And I think it's great. Anyway, let's talk about the story a little bit, because we haven't really talked about... that very much. The premise here is that they're honouring a Russian general, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got quite a serious undertone here, because there was a lot of concern within World War II about communists, and of course there was a Soviet...
You know, I'm sorry to interrupt, Frank is there, yet later he will arrive on his bike, having been knocked off. Frank's in the back there, look.
I'm trying to see whether that's Frank.
I've just seen Frank stood up and he's got his hat on.
With the hat on.
Yeah. And he got up and, I'm sorry to interrupt, but he stood up and shook someone's hand, yet you will see him when John Lemez arrives, arriving on his bike.
Oh, well. Well, here you are. Here's the Rolls Royce.
I'm sure he arrives when John does, in a minute, on his bike. And he's because I didn't think Frank was in this scene, and I've just noticed him there, instead of sat on the bandstand.
I'm trying, I can't tell for definite whether he's sat behind Ian. I can see some chap in a hat, yes.
I'm sure it's Frank.
All
right, but okay. you're absolutely right. The plot, and we've got this, and it is there's a serious undertone here.
Yeah. I mean, it's not something that I'm particularly knowledgeable about myself. And what I'll do, I'm going to read the part that about this particular plot point that's on the Wikipedia page for this episode, and it says this episode demonstrates the uneasy alliance that had been formed between the capitalist Great Britain and the communist Soviet Union. Many of Warmington's citizens are uneasy about honouring a red, in inverted commas, and having the red flag sung. This wasn't quite a common sentiment at the time. Sorry, this was quite a common sentiment at the time, though, as Mannerin puts it, in time of war, one can't be too choosy about one's bedfellows. And it's quite an interesting subject to centre an episode around, I think.
Yes.
And I just wondered... did Dad's Army actually tackle something more socially relevant at the time of the war, really, than the communist involvement and the relations between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union at the time, than in this episode? I have a feeling that they probably didn't tackle anything more serious than that.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a huge credit to Jimmy and David. As the series progressed, you know, they were able to pick out moments like this. I think you're absolutely right. I don't think in terms of, you know, foreign relations and talking about the aspect at the time. No, I think this is easily the best episode. Robert Raglan, I think he's fantastic. Well, I love the character of the Colonel. He's sort of that sort of staple, and in the film he played a police detective. Yeah.
Don't quite understand why he didn't play the Colonel.
Yeah, I know, because
very strange. But he only comes into it partway through the run of Dad's Army.
Yeah, and then becomes a sergeant. Wasn't he Captain Square's sergeant?
Yes, now I'm not sure. I mean, if you speak to the Appreciation Society, I'd say Appreciation Society, if you speak to Paul, he thinks that it's the same character who suddenly rises through the ranks meteorically. Yeah. I take a different view on that. I think it just happens to be the same actor playing two different characters.
Yeah.
That's my view. Or else he would have, you know...
That's quite a rise, isn't it, from sergeant to colonel.
I know the ranks within the Home Guards were extremely fluid, and they weren't confirmed until, you know, a good time after the Home Guards had been established, but... I don't think someone would have suddenly shot up that quickly. And even if they had, relations between Square and Raglan, Square and Colonel Pritchard, would have been terse. And they never were. They never were.
No.
I just want to mention one other thing as well, because we're coming towards the end of this episode now, is that I think it's extremely rare that you can compare episodes of Dad's Army and say one is very similar to the other.
Mm.
I think this episode... what is very similar to another episode? And I'll put you on the spot. Can you think of anything? I'll give you a couple of clues if you like.
Yeah.
They're honouring a foreign national.
Yes.
They had a committee to decide how to honour this national.
Yeah.
They've come up with a ceremony that forms essentially the climax to the episode. And it all ends in a little bit of a...
my British cock buddy? Up. I don't know.
Close. Now, I'm thinking of the captain's car.
Oh, yeah.
Because they honour a French general then.
Of course. And... oh, yeah. And there's a band there.
Yeah.
I'll mention now, because I've made a cock up here, because, I mean, I've never noticed Frank on that bandstand before, and he's there now. And whenever I've seen this before, I thought he'd arrived on his bike, having been knocked off.
So are you telling me you interrupted me making my most serious point in a podcast
about communism
to get something wrong?
To get something really wrong.
Well, no, not to worry.
Yeah, but I never... I don't know. Well, the vicar must be a very fast cyclist to have been knocked off.
Well, he's not very good, is he? Well, he's probably stood in a ditch, and maybe that other person on the band just looks like the vicar.
Yeah, yeah.
Who knows? But, no, I got to say, I do like this episode. I think it's... For me, it's not one of the best. I do find it interesting because it addresses the class issue head on.
Yeah.
But I do think the storyline is very, very similar to The Captain's Car. And I think a lot of the little tricks and the gags are used again. I'm trying to think. Captain's Car was at a later series, wasn't it? I think it was Series 7.
Yes, because Taffer and Thomas is in it. You're absolutely right.
So they're actually quite close together as well. And I can't think of another two episodes that are so directly comparable.
No.
So, anyway, Oliver, thank you once again for joining me. Thank you for the brandy and thank you for your thank you for your expert opinion.
Just a fan, and it's a great pleasure.
Wonderful.
Watching Dad's Army with you. Hope you enjoy the podcast. It's one. Sorry.
Outtake. I'll start again.